the peace and security inside in the true sense of the world, on that time, I think the whole world and the mechanism of the world is going to work properly. And there is no need for an exterior power to execute security and peace for the world. There would be no war. There would be no discrimination. There would be no orphan in the world. There would be no, I don't know, atomic attacks on different countries. Isn't it, Sheikh Hassan?
Yeah, actually, you brought up these mystical approaches or mystical movements that are now are a sort of on a rise in the whole world. I think the difference that we can distinguish between these sorts of movements, mystical movements, and the one that the mystical or the tranquility seeking basics that we can find in Islam is that these sorts of modern ones, they lack both the beginning al-mabda and the end al-ma'ad. So this is the problem that they have. So they do not start from the mabda of this world because they don't recognize God as many of them.
Yes.
Or mostly they don't recognize God as the creator of the world and the beginning of the creation and being.
There is a God for them, but say live it and get to you yourself.
Yeah, not a true one. Okay. So
you are the center of everything. Okay.
Yeah, so you are the center and you are everything to for this world and in this world. And you're not going anywhere, you know? So what is that? The thing is that between these two infinities or nothingness that they have. Let me put not infinities, but nothingness that they're experiencing. You try to just keep up with what is going on in the world.
Oh.
So this is what happens in these sorts of mystical approaches that they have. Contrary to what we see in Islam, that is coming up and that is starting from God, the beginning of the whole being in existence. Yes. And then going towards him again.
Mm-hmm.
So inna lillah wa inna ilayhi raji'un. And this is the one sentence prescription of the mystical Islamic mystical system actually.
Okay.
So this is the problem.
I mean mysticism, you mean Irfan?
By mystics, I mean Irfan, but not the in scientific way.
Scientific way. Yeah, you mean Irfan in the true sense of the word. Okay.
So I was watching this show. It was a sort of debate between two, one atheist and a theist.
Okay.
And this atheist, I don't want to call the names. So this one, she said that I've been meditating for 30 years and I feel this tranquility and things like that. And then she said, I every time that I wake up, I thank the universe. And then I give thanks, to whatever is around me and things like that.
Okay.
And then that person, the theist one, he said that, who are you thanking? She said, I'm thanking the universe. He said, okay, what is this universe that you're thanking, mm-hmm. or you're thankful for and from? And she didn't have anything, If this universe is just like yourself, is something that is going to perish sooner and later, so it's just a sort of stupid thing to do. What are you thanking for?
And if you ask the universe, I think, if you got a tongue and ask the universe, who are you thanking? For sure, the answer will be Allah Subhanahu wa Taala.
Yeah, sure.
So, thank you much, Sheikh Qasim and Sheikh Sadeq, for your presence in the program Viewpoints. It was very kind of you, and thank you much, dear listener, for listening to us. To another episode, God be with you. Fi amanallah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I when I have you to doubt you would be the worst to stay deep inside? I know it's the darkness and everything which makes no sense. Know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights. Shows me right from wrong. A world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life. But you know I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
Round the world with reporters. Israeli arms firms with special relationships to Britain might seek to profiteer from a possible new refugee crisis following the West's chaotic retreat from Afghanistan. This was the warning issued by co-founders of the UK-based Palestine Action Group, who have long fought to shut down the UK branches of Elbit Systems, a notorious Israeli weapons manufacturer.
We've seen what's happened recently as well with, I think it was 800 people who entered this country, and there's talks of, you know, taking them back, etc., or stopping them from coming here in the first place. This is the technology that they will be using to try and stop people from seeking safety after many of these people have gone through war, have seen their communities destroyed, so companies like Elbit can profit.
Debates over the UK's commitment to refugees and treatment of illegal entry to the UK has resurfaced in recent weeks, with the government introducing stricter measures to halt illegal channel crossings of desperate refugees fleeing war zones. In past years, Britain has already purchased Israeli-built drone technology to track illegal entry attempts, with further purchases on the horizon.
It's been battle-tested, proven how it works in Gaza. So the same technology which is used to harass and surveil Palestinians. The UK are not only hosting Elbit sites to produce these drones, but they're actually making contracts to buy these very same drones in order to surveil the channel to stop migrants and refugees from seeking safety in this country. If you see someone about to be hurt, most people would step in the way. And that applies when we know that these weapons being produced here will be used to kill other people who, in a lot of circumstances, are powerless to what that weapon can do.
Both France and the United Nations have expressed grave concern at the UK's new tactics, which they feel could lead to many needless drownings in the English Channel, while Israel's arms industry is providing Britain the tools it needs in order to hunt down these vulnerable vessels. That's just another reason why Palestine Action feels so determined to see Elbit shut down. Robert Carter, Leicester.
After some 13 months of a deadlock in the country and a descending multifaceted crisis, Lebanon saw the birth of a new cabinet led by Najib Miqati. Miqati stressed that he will do everything in his power to stop Lebanon's collapse.
The situation is difficult but not impossible to deal with if we cooperate together as Lebanese. We need to work hand in hand. Today, the president and I work on forming this cabinet, and it is not perfect, but only God is perfect. I can assure you that we are a team and we will work as one until we stop all the despair. I will leave at nothing to contact all international organizations to try to provide the minimum of good living and at least stop the collapse.
Lebanon's new prime minister urged the political groups to cooperate and give this government confidence to work as a team. President Michel Aoun told reporters off camera that the new government will begin addressing the concerns of the Lebanese, adding that Lebanon will get out of hell and rise from the abyss. A lineup of 24 ministers was announced on Friday from the Lebanese presidential palace.
The challenges this cabinet faces are economic, financial, monetary, and social. Therefore, it needs to hurry in putting together a salvation plan. This plan should include short-term objectives and finding quick solutions, since this cabinet has only an 8-month term and therefore cannot put long-term plans. This is possible either through talks with the International Monetary Fund or through implementing the reform plan, which was endorsed by the French initiative.
With the government now formed, the Lebanese parliament will soon convene to issue a vote of confidence for the Miqati government. After a little over 1 month, Prime Minister Najib Mikati has finally managed to form a cabinet in accordance with President Michel Aoun. However, the various challenges that lie ahead with regards to the socioeconomic and the financial crisis are far from over. Maryam Saleh from Baabda's Presidential Palace.
South Korea's weapons are rapidly advancing. Following the introduction of a larger class of submarines in 2018, the country last week test-fired a submarine-launched ballistic missile. This and other advanced weapons in development emphasize military deterrence against perceived foreign threats, including North Korea, despite calling on Pyongyang to negotiate denuclearization and arms reductions. Activists argue such policies undermine national security.
The Moon Jae-in administration introducing aggressive and advanced weapons and holding joint military drills with the U.S. hinder trust building between South Korea and North Korea, as well as the Korean Peninsula peace process. South Korea's armed forces have been pursuing long-distance capabilities, for example, with a light aircraft carrier. This aggressive arms build-up plan could intensify the arms race in Northeast.
South Korea is in the process of choosing a light aircraft carrier, with two of South Korea's major shipbuilders intensifying competition for the project. Seoul Friday also announced it would build two larger SLBM-capable submarines. Activists argue South Korea's near $50 billion defense spending should be reallocated.
People affected by the COVID pandemic have not received enough financial support. Arms spending should be reduced and taxes should be allocated for more urgent issues such as developing a sustainable economy and the environment.
South Korea's arms production is at such a scale to be considered a military-industrial complex. Many of South Korea's largest corporations are heavily invested in the industry, which carries significant economic and political influence. South Korea also recently outlined development of a bunker-busting bomb to be deployed on a ballistic missile, following an agreement with the U.S. to eliminate limits on South Korea's missile payload and range. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Speakers of parliament from around the world gather in Vienna to focus on the most urgent matter of the day, the COVID pandemic.
Most participants concluded the world has not shown competency in dealing with the COVID pandemic, with unilateral policies blocking the vital multilateralism required for joint research and the fair distribution of vaccines.
Iran is among those hardest hit by the pandemic, and the country's visiting MPs say U.S. sanctions are hampering efforts to control the virus.
The unjust sanctions that the U.S. has imposed on Iran have made us unable to import medicines and medical supplies or to take action to remedy the current situation in the country. We need to create fair and equal conditions for all, even if it's solely for the sake of controlling the virus.
Cuba was another country that complained about U.S. sanctions.
The U.S. government has been tightening the embargo that is throttling us. Even food and medicines are being kept out, and vital medical supplies are withheld.
Azerbaijan criticized the fact that some countries are stocking up on far more vaccines than their actual needs, while poorer nations are left behind. In Yemen, said the country's representative, people live amidst war, poverty, and hunger, and need vaccines as well as international assistance. To produce one kind of vaccine, the conference was told, a manufacturing company needs ingredients from 19 different countries. No one country can do this alone. So why is the technology not being shared? All hopes lie with the vaccination campaign, but will economic incentives continue to override humanitarian ones? Homolezki, Vienna.
Weeks after the fall of Kabul to the Taliban and only a few days after the group's spokesman declared victory of Panjshir clash, the Taliban announced the lineup of its caretaker government.
محترم
الحاج محمد حسن آخوند has been appointed as the acting prime minister. Mullah Abdul Ghani برادر and مولوی عبدالسلام حنفی will serve as his deputies. مولوی محمد یعقوب مجاهد and الحاج مullah سراج الدین حقانی are also appointed as the acting defense and interior ministers. مولوی امیر خان متقی serves as acting foreign minister of the caretaker government.
The declaration of the caretaker government of Taliban has sparked mixed reactions inside and abroad. Many have criticized the Taliban for not forming an inclusive government. They, for instance, argue that all members of the newly declared acting cabinet ministers are Taliban figures. Moreover, the absence of women in Taliban's caretaker government is considered as one of the other causes behind rising criticism among Afghans, especially women. In protest to the lineup of Taliban's caretaker government, Afghan women took to the streets of Kabul and voiced their anger at the absence of women in the newly declared cabinet ministers. Despite this, Taliban officials insist that they are fully committed to respect and even protect women's rights. They also said will declare an inclusive government that will remove all current public concerns and criticisms.
Our country is facing numerous challenges, mainly poverty. Furthermore, the country has just left behind a crisis. Now security is restored to all parts of the country. So we declared this caretaker government to manage the urgent in a better way. We will, of course, declare an inclusive government soon.
We want security and don't care who brings it to us. If they are right, the Taliban must help us go back to our village in northeastern Badakhshan. I also ask the Taliban to avoid any further violence in the country by establishing an inclusive government.
Besides local reactions to the declaration of Taliban's government, some states, including China and Uzbekistan, have welcomed this recent move of Taliban in terms of declaring and acting cabinet ministers. Some other countries, however, insist that the only legitimate government in Afghanistan will be the one which must take power based on the will of the people of Afghanistan. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The visit of Qatar's foreign minister is the latest in a series of visits undertaken by foreign dignitaries to Pakistan in recent days. Following the visits of foreign ministers of Germany, Italy, UK and Netherlands, the visit of Qatar's top diplomat also focused on Afghanistan. His visit comes just days after the Afghan Taliban announced an interim government that drew criticism from certain Western countries for ignoring the demands of inclusive setup. Speaking at a joint news conference, Pakistani Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi said the immediate priority must be the well-being of the people of Afghanistan.
And the most important thing that we both agree to is that we have to protect the interests of the people of Afghanistan. And for that, their safety, their security, stability, and to ensure that this Afghanistan, you know, does not become an arena for, you know, for proxy wars.
Since the Taliban took over, there have been fears of economic meltdown as the international financial institutions and Western countries suspended the assistance.
Humanitarian situation and the humanitarian assistance should be independent from any political progress, because we believe that the Afghan people deserve to be helped, deserve to be supported, despite what's happening in the political landscape.
The Qatari foreign minister said the inclusive government is important for the unity of Afghanistan. The interim government announced by the Taliban was contrary to the commitment they made earlier that the political dispensation would be inclusive and broad-based. The interim government is set to take oath on the 20th anniversary of 9/11 attacks in the United States. Many countries are closely watching the Taliban whether they live up to their promises. But Pakistan and Qatar maintain that the world community should not take any steps that may aggravate the problems for the people of Afghanistan. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Palestinians organized several rallies in the Gaza Strip in solidarity with Palestinian detainees in Israeli jails, where tensions mounted as Israeli regime began to practice a brutal crackdown on Palestinian prisoners and transfer them to new facilities. Palestinian inmates set fire to cells protesting the Israeli violent measures against them that have doubled after six Palestinian inmates escaped Jalbu prison early this week.
Palestinian inmates in Israeli jails have been facing a war crime, especially after the heroic escape by six Palestinian inmates from Jalbu prison. Israel has adopted violent measures against Palestinian detainees, including solitary confinement.
Palestinian resistance factions called prisoners to resist these attempts to transfer them to various facilities, describing the condition in Israeli jails as war crime that requires urgent move to protect the Palestinian detainees. Palestinian Prisoners Club warned that tension would escalate between Palestinian detainees and the Israeli regime over the relocating of some detainees from the Islamic Jihad movement, as most of the six inmates are affiliated with the group.
The Palestinian resistance has a clear message that any Israeli attack threatening the lives of the prisoners will lead to serious consequences, and the Israeli regime will pay a heavy price for any violation. Our Palestinian resistance is ready to defend our detainees. Also, it's a national Palestinian duty to provide safety for the six heroes who have escaped the Israeli prison.
Palestinians called the international community and human rights groups to make serious actions in order to protect the Palestinian detainees from the Israeli violence.
We hope that all Palestinian detainees will be free soon. We are here to support our inmates. We won't remain silent amid the international community's apathy towards the issue. We will raise our voices against the international conventions that are only written on paper with no practical results.
Six Palestinian inmates escaped from the high-security Jalbu prison in northern parts of the occupied territories on Monday, prompting a massive manhunt by Israeli army. Along with its manhunt for six Palestinian detainees, the Israeli army has practiced violent measures against detainees inside jails. Palestinians here say they can't remain silent as the prisoners' issue is among their top priorities. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
The British government has come under renewed condemnation after failing to honour their pledge to define Islamophobia 2 years after making the initial promise, with MPs and critics all condemning the lack of action amid rising Islamophobia across the UK. An all-party parliamentary group on British Muslims created their own definition of Islamophobia in 2018, describing it as a form of racism.
Islamophobia is rooted in racism and is a type of racism that targets expressions of Muslimness or perceived Muslimness.
Regardless which political group makes the definition, grassroots British Muslim groups are concerned over what they see as an establishment-pushed definition.
The best case scenario for this definition of Islamophobia would be one that forces the government to critically self-reflect and critically analyse its policies and policies of previous governments that have led to Islamophobia. I do specifically mean the so-called counter-extremism policies, which have just been a thinly veiled excuse to surveil the Muslim community. And these policies have had such detrimental impacts on the mental and physical well-being of the Muslim community. It's so likely we're going to have a watered-down definition that is nothing more than empty words. Why? Because there's been no engagement with the grassroots of society. There's been no engagement with organisations like ours, like MPAC UK, or CAGE, or MEND, or, critically, active masajid like Lewisham Islamic Centre. There's been no engagement with organisations like these which have had to deal with the mess created by 20 years of suspicion and policies and institutionalized Islamophobia.
Some have already begun to adopt the definition, including the opposition Labour Party. However, accusations of Islamophobia within Labour remain, despite its implementation.
A lot of skepticism still surrounds this definition, with many fearing that it will ultimately fail to serve the community effectively, if at all. However, while MPs continue to procrastinate on the issue, Islamophobia remains a very real and persistent threat on both a street and systemic level. Robert Carter, London.
For the first time in 10 years, the Syrian army has entered Dar' al-Balad in Dar'a city. This is an implementation of a long negotiated deal with armed men that collapsed many times because of their violations. 9 checkpoints for the Syrian army have been established to ensure security after 900 armed men reconciled and surrendered their arms. Russian military police is also there, patrolling and supervising the deal's implementation. The Syrian flag was also raised on Al-Manshiya Police Department inside, signaling the return of law and order to the area.
Today, Dar al-Balad returns to Syria with efforts of people and security forces. Reconciliation talks have been successful. The armed forces and police have entered the town and 9 security checkpoints have been established.
The government's control over Dar al-Balad will lead to the reopening of public institutions and providing basic services to the residents, as well as reconstruction.
As you can see, security and stability have been restored. The town has a strategic location along Syria's border with Jordan. The restoration of public services is highly important for the residents of Dar al-Balad.
Meanwhile, Al-Mukhayyam quarter remains under the control of armed groups who refuse any peaceful deal with the government, similar to some villages west of Dar'a. Thousands of people who left the town before a peaceful deal were allowed to return to their homes, marking the end of yet another chapter of an armed conflict in Syria. The military regaining control of Dar'a al-Balad is a testament to what Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has said time and again, that the army is determined to retake every inch of Syrian territory. After 10 years of war, the government continues to prioritize peaceful solutions to end any conflict, like the one here in Dar al-Balad. Hamad Ali, Dar al-Balad, southern Syria.
The healthcare system in Yemen is deteriorating due to the ongoing Saudi blockade that has led to a harsh shortage of fuel. Sana Health Bureau said 100 health facilities had to stop providing health services partially or completely due to their inability to generate power anymore.
The fuel cuts in our country due to the blockade and aggression have affected the ability of health facilities to provide the necessary health services to our people. Our hospital has been negatively affected so that we have no way but to increase the charge of our services, and this constitutes an additional burden on Yemenis, especially amid the war and siege.
A civilian maternal hospital in Yemen's capital Sana'a used to have 45,000 liters of diesel each month as a grant from the World Health Organization. However, the world body, the hospital said, has stopped its fuel grant due to what it says, financial problems.
We are Sab'een Hospital in Sana'a. It is the referral hospital for maternity and the childhood disease. We are, before we received oil from the WHO, during 2021, the amount of the oil received to the hospital is become decreased to the fourth, the amount already we receive it. It is big catastrophe. It will lead to the death of the many child and woman, especially that admitted in the ICU, in the nursery, and the OT. Here in the hospital, we decrease most of our services to decrease the use of the electricity.
Earlier, Yemen's petroleum company said only 3 oil ships were allowed to arrive at Hudaydah port since the beginning of 2021, covering only 3% of what is required to fulfill the basic needs of Yemenis. The Saudi war and the blockade have led Yemen to the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations.
Yemen's healthcare system is on the verge of collapse as a result of the Islamic Saudi war and the blockade. Yemenis also blame the United Nations for their suffering, saying the world body should take real measures against the continuous Saudi violations of their rights. Abdul Latif Loshali, Sana'a.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
For generals like David Petraeus and Lloyd Austin, there has been no punishment for 20 years of disinformation on Afghanistan and Iraq, says Peter Moss, writer, in an article titled General Failure, How the U.S. Military Lied About the 9/11 Wars. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. After 20 years of conducting a disinformation campaign about what was really happening on the ground, not a single U.S. general has faced any punishment. The reverse happened. They were praised for their deceptively upbeat assessments and given more stars. And when they retired with generous military pensions, they landed high-paying jobs on corporate boards, further profiting from their disingenuousness. This disconnect is getting new scrutiny after the collapse of the American campaign in Afghanistan. In Afghanistan and Iraq, several hundred thousand civilians and combatants have perished, including more than 7,000 American troops. Millions of people have become refugees, and trillions of dollars have been wasted. Politicians were responsible for this. Pundits were responsible, and so-called experts from think tanks were responsible too. But the generals were closest to these wars and most aware should have been of what was happening. Few were closer or profited more than two in particular. General Lloyd Austin, who is now Secretary of Defense, and General David Petraeus, one of the most lauded military figures of the past 20 years. Since 9/11, U.S. generals have consistently failed to see what was happening before their eyes, or they knew what was happening and lied about it. In congressional testimony, in media interviews, and in speeches to their troops, Austin and other generals who oversaw the 9/11 wars did the opposite of telling the truth. It's crucial to understand what the generals were not saying. Austin, for instance, congratulated the Afghan military for having retaken and re-established security in key areas such as Kunduz. He did not mention that the battle for Kunduz involved a U.S. aircraft attacking a hospital and killing 42 civilians, doctors, nurses, and patients. It was the kind of civilian slaughter that typified U.S. and Afghan military operations, and that doomed the war. Austin, an entire generation of generals, did their best to avoid mentioning these inconvenient details, denying them unless they were confronted with irrefutable evidence and then doing little in the aftermath to prevent these atrocities from reoccurring. In 2012, the journalist Thomas Ricks, who had spent much of his life covering and studying the U.S. military, wrote a slashing article that described the history of American generals after 9/11 as a tale of ineptitude exacerbated by wholesale lack of accountability. Ricks went on, "Ironically, U.S. generals have grown worse as they have been lionized more and more by society, now reflexively differential to the military. The U.S. had distributed 98,000 sets of body armor to the new Iraqi forces," Petraeus said with enthusiasm, or what he wanted to be understood as enthusiasm. This was largely a fiction. The security forces in question were embryonic, generally ineffectual, and entirely dependent on not just American supplies, but on American troops leading the fight. Petraeus was doing what pretty much every general who served in Iraq and Afghanistan would do, stringing together any data he could find that would masquerade as a narrative of success. The statistics on his PowerPoint were vintage Vietnam. Find big numbers and call them victory. The tactics employed by these U.S.-trained commandos were violently illegal. The cynicism of America's most famous general emerged after the publication of the story, which had the cover headline, "The Salvadorization of Iraq," referring to the dirty war in El Salvador in 1980s. In 2007, Petraeus was named the commander of U.S. forces in Iraq and became famous for implementing a strategy of counterinsurgency that he portrayed as focusing on protecting civilians and winning their hearts and minds. It was the opposite of what he was hoping to get credit for his brutish commandos 2 years earlier. The contrast showed the lack of sincerity in their strategy. Yet those strategies had one thing in common. They provided a justification for keeping the war going, offering an illusion of victory on the horizon. The more important truth was that civilian casualties were rising. The casualty figures showed that Afghanistan was growing more unstable and insecure, the exact opposite of what the U.S. strategy was supposed to accomplish. U.S. intelligence assessments also cast doubts on the war's progress. Intelligence analysts in the CIA and the military prepared reports that were far more pessimistic than the pronouncements from commanding generals in the field. But intelligence officials rarely spoke in public, and their reports remained classified.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio and to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems, issues, and other questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. As usual, all of the answers are based upon the Holy Quran and the narrations of the Prophet and the household of the Prophet, peace be upon them all. Joining us in our studio is our guest speaker, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi, who is a researcher at the Islamic Seminary of Qom. Dear Sayyid, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. Our issue today is about the mistakes of our children and how we as parents should fix them in a correct manner. Dear Sayyid, please enlighten us.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. One of the biggest problems that parents, we as parents face, is dealing with the mistakes of our kids. And sadly, not a lot of parents that possess the right skills to deal with their kids when they're making a mistake. And sometimes we forget the most basic things, which is there anyone out of us as a human beings that doesn't make a mistake? Unless you're infallible, unless you're a ma'soom, then obviously not. But as long as you're not infallible, then you'll make a mistake. There's no one that doesn't make a mistake. So why is it that when a child does a mistake, the whole world goes up and down, and the mother just goes into rage, and the father goes into rage? And
so much intolerance.
Yeah, and I've seen situations where a child makes a mistake, the parents beat them to death. Sometimes the children end up losing a limb and causing damage severely because the parents, for example, you know, the child make a mistake and the parents go crazy. Or is it because the child keep repeating their mistake? We all keep repeating our mistakes. If Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants to, you know, take me for my sins that I keep repeating, I wouldn't last 2 minutes.
None would last 2 minutes.
Yeah, Allah says, you know, the beautiful version of the Quran, there would be no one left on earth if he would to punish them.
Exactly.
So why is it that when it comes to kids that we, you know, get angry? Is it because they keep repeating it? Or, I mean, when we were kids, didn't we make mistakes? I remember my father used to call me, you know, it's like you're the devil. That's how active I was.
Many colorful expressions.
Yeah, it's like very colorful expressions. But I was such an active person. I was an active child that I was running around. We were living in a village, right? So yeah. I was running around, going on trees and doing things. And, you know, sometimes parents just can't handle such, you know, an active child.
Hyperactive child.
Hyperactive child. And, you know, so, and then I said to myself, well, weren't you guys like this back in the day? Weren't you children as well? Weren't you hyperactive? Why is it when it comes to us, for example, or when it comes to our children, we kind of neglect that? That as if we, when we were kids, we were perfect, we were super perfect. We made mistakes, we kept repeating mistakes, we done all these things. So why is it when it comes to a child makes a mistake that we shut away, jump and attack?
Great question.
Yeah. And again, like, you know, you have to look at it from this perspective. Mind you, I'm just trying to give a bit of intro before we go into the topic. That sometimes when you walk with your child and your child falls, he falls and, you know, he trips and falls, what's the first reaction that you do? You run to him, try to help him out, make sure he's okay, right? You don't see him, like, he trips and he falls, and you come and you just slap him, for example, you hit him, why did you fall? You don't do that, right? So what you do is you try to help him out. Well, actually, some parents might do that, which is sad.
That's why I'm smiling. Some people actually do that.
Yeah, so yeah, I actually seen that. Well, they make a mistake, they even get bashed more, which is even sadder.
Exactly.
But generally speaking, is that you're trying to help.
Of course. And on that note, we'll go on a quick break.
When I was born, the first words that I had heard were the words of Allah being whispered through my ear. And as I felt Allah's presence in my soul, that day Islam took me in its fold.
Dear listeners, welcome back to IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing, where we're discussing how to correctly fix the mistakes of our children. Dear Sayyid, please enlighten us.
So we were saying that when our kids usually go into a problem or they face something out of their own hands, we see ourselves trying to at least save them, you know, at least with the majority of the parents. So we say, isn't it better for parents to learn the ways and methods of how they could correct the mistakes of their children and how they could deal with their children and how they could rectify their behaviors, and this way they could, you know, embed in them self-esteem and make them feel good about themselves and make them feel that they are human beings nevertheless at the end of the day? Or should we just slap them and punish them and just destroy their self-esteem, destroy their identity, kill their creativity, kill their spirituality, whatever you can think of that comes from hitting a child or punishing a child for a mistake that he did? It will have such a negative impact that will grow with him. Most of the listeners, they could relate to something that happened to them by their parents, as me and you could relate to some of the mistakes that maybe our parents made in trying to raise us. Which is a mistake, it's very easy to fix if parents put their mind into how they can deal and fix with the issue, which is very simple, very easy.
So, dear Sayyid, what is this simple solution you speak of?
All right, so the solution is the fact that as parents, it all has to do with the way you see things. It's not like a recipe that you have to put all the right ingredients in. It's just very simple as how you see things. For example, when a child makes a mistake, don't concentrate on the child himself or on the mistake itself, rather on what made the mistake happen in the first place, right? So the child himself, he's just a player,
right?
He's just a part. He's not the mistake, right? If the child, for example, yells and screams and hits, it's not him, right? There is a cause that's making the child do that mistake. If the child, for example, breaks things, so he's stealing things, so he's loud, or his akhlaq is bad, then know that there is something behind it. He's not
so
the cause.
The cause is the mistake, and the child's action is just the result.
Yeah, so the child makes the mistake. So the child is just a part of the problem. He is not the problem.
So if you think about this mathematically, you have a result, a number result, for example, and that is the child's actions. You cannot change the result when you have an addition that led to this result, right? You
got
to fix those first.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So unless you fix the formula first, the result will change. So with a child, he's just a number that gives you the solution, the result. So for example, when the child himself, let's say he makes a mistake, I don't know, he's just constantly angry, always yelling and screaming. Don't try to silence the child. Don't try to slap the child. Be quiet and this and that.
Right.
Well, that's not going to solve the problem.
It will make it
then
worse.
Yeah, it will make it worse. So, or it causes even more mistakes. So you ask yourself, what is making him like this? You know, these days when a child does something wrong, the parents, or at least in some societies, those who are smart parents, they take their kids to a psychologist. They're like, okay, you know what? My child's not acting properly. His actions and his behavior is not normal. I can't put my finger on it why he keeps doing it. Let me take him to a professional.
Right.
So they take him to a psychologist, a therapist, and then they're like, okay, you know what? Tell me what's wrong with my child. What's making him do this? Well, this is the right approach if you can't do it yourself. But at the end of the day, you can always see that if you put your mind into it, you can definitely figure out where the child is going wrong, or what's happening, what's causing him to be like this.
And on that note, we will take a quick break.
Imam As-Sajjad alayhi salam said, "A child's right is to be kind to him when educating him, forgiving him, covering his mistakes, acting moderately towards him, and helping him."
Dear listeners, welcome back to IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss how to solve problems and issues parents face when raising their children in an Islamic way. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
So when we were saying the solution is very simple, it's just a matter of looking at things differently. That's all we're trying to get at.
It is so crazy simple, if I may interrupt you, to say that it is so obvious. Like whenever you have a problem, a computer problem, or a car problem, or something, you always say, okay, what is the cause of this problem?
Exactly.
You don't go on and beat on the part till it works.
Exactly. So this is like, sometimes like they say that the best solution are the easiest solutions. Sometimes like I've done this quiz with the students once, with the grown-ups.
Right.
And I said to them, you know, they have this difference between an adult mentality and a child mentality. So I said, how do you put an elephant inside the fridge?
Yeah.
And everyone said, it's impossible.
You can't,
right? A child said to him, how do you put an elephant in the fridge? He says, open the fridge, put the elephant, close the door.
Exactly, yeah.
Done. Because he just sees it as simple, right? He doesn't complicate things himself. He's thinking out of the box.
That's
so with
the
these things
part.
Are the same.
I do not understand. Like the solution is so simple to figure out, okay, my child, he has bad behavior.
Mm.
What causes this? Why don't parents think this way?
I'll tell you what. It's a number of reasons. One, sometimes the parents themselves are the cause. When I am the disease myself, I don't see myself as a disease. I see myself as a fixer.
Right.
So, for example, my behavior with my child, for example, we have a lot of angry parents and a lot of angry mothers. And some of them, they are scary in the nature that the kids feel scared.
Right.
So the kids, because they are so scared from the parents, for example, or the parents, they have their own teaching methods, that the child keeps making a mistake because he doesn't know what to do anymore. Right? Does this make my dad happy? Does this that make him happy? Is that what he wants? Or they think that the parents think in a certain way that the child constantly makes a mistake. The mistake is not the child. You are the mistake as a parent. When you don't have the right method to teach your kids, and you take such a personality, and you create your own demon, obviously that poor child's not going to see it. And as people, I mean, as grown-ups, we never see our mistakes. We see the mistakes of everybody, but we never see our mistakes.
Exactly.
So especially when as parents, so sometimes the educator or the parent himself is the problem. Sometimes the environment that you've created in the house, for example, the way that you've, for example, I know fathers, this one specific case, where the father is very touchy about children touching the walls of the couches or TVs and stuff like that.
So
he's constantly putting the kids in this state of fear. But sometimes things happen. He's a child. He will literally or, you know, a way or another, he will touch something or create something. And then you see the father just go, wow, why are you doing it? I'm like, you created such an environment.
He made a prison.
He can't move in. Yeah,
right.
So obviously.
You constrained him.
Yeah, some mistakes are bound to happen.
Right. Do say it. I must unfortunately interrupt the discussion because the time for today's program is up. Dear listeners, I thank you for listening to us. And as usual, if you have any questions, comments, or some feedback, please visit our website, englishradio@irib.ir. You can also alternatively visit our website, parstoday.com. Until another program, fi amanillah.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent.
and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.